you'll enjoy it and that you'll find it stimulating and get conceptual refreshment from it. One overall thing is that we hope that you will interrupt us and ask questions at every stage. So we have a bunch of material prepared, but or not prepared, as the case may be, but we're not going to get through it anyway. So even if you don't say a word, we're not going to finish. So it's much more important that you ask questions and understand than we get through any set amount of stuff. So please do just say if you don't understand something. That's the whole point, is to be clear and for you to understand. So I'm going to give an introduction to causal sets today. And I've called it a quick jog down one road to causal sets. It's not the historical one. I don't think that anyone could actually probably properly reconstruct the historical route to causal sets. And the way that I'm going to try to set things up so that causal sets appear natural, but obviously bear that in mind that I'm doing things deliberately in order that they seem natural to you. So I'll start by making some very brief comments about the problem of quantum gravity. Causal sets are the basis for an approach to the problem of quantum gravity. So what do we mean by that? I'll then step back from quantum gravity and think a little bit about classical gravity, in other words, general relativity. And I'll emphasize and focus on a particular structure in classical gravity that's not often focused on. And that is the causal structure of space-time. And I'll show you, I'll quote a result that in a very precise sense means that causal structure is 9/10 of the metric in 4 dimensions, and that the remaining 1/10 of the metric can be recovered by knowing all the information about volumes, space-time volumes of regions. And I'll quote the result, and I'll give you some small indications about how that can be, how you can recover geometrical information from causal structure. Okay, then I'm not going to argue for discreteness. There are many reasons that people believe that the fundamental substructure of space-time is not smooth and continuous, but discrete and granular. And so I'll just assume that that's what we want to do. We want to find a discrete underpinning to continuum space-time. And I'll argue that causal sets do the job for us in a way that is inherently Lorentzian. So the discreteness of causal sets somehow is tied to the Lorentzian nature of continuum space-time. And I'll show you some pictures which I claim show that the Lorentzianness of space-time is actually revealed by the discreteness in a way that no other method, at least that I know, can do. So you can't really understand Lorentzianness and the Lorentzian structure of space-time except in the context of discreteness. Okay, so the two things go together, Lorentzian structure and discreteness, they complete each other, they're coupled together. Okay, I'll stress that causal sets are Lorentz invariant, and I'll say what I mean by that. And I'll contrast that situation with lattice-like discretizations of space-time. And I'll end, if I ever get there, with a partial list of things that you can think about if you have a causal set hat on. You might say, what can causal sets do for me? And there's a whole bunch of things that, even if you don't believe in them as fundamental, you can use causal sets to hang your discrete ideas on. And they're just a very useful way to think about a space-time which has uncertainty at the Planck scale, if you like. It's just something that you can do, if you like, in your spare time. You can think about causal sets, see whether they can throw light on any particular question that you're interested in. Okay. So what is quantum gravity? Well, it's really a shorthand that gives a name to the biggest obstacle that faces us in our search for a unified framework for the whole of physics. So if the unified framework is what we're after, then the discrepancy between quantum theory and classical gravity, in other words, general relativity, is, if you like, the biggest dislocation in it's the most ununified bit of current physics. So if we focus on that, worst discrepancy, then it's right to call this search for a unified framework quantum gravity. Okay, what gravity and what quantum theory? And the answers to these questions will, in some way, inform the direction that you take in this search. So, and the question, what gravity, is answered by pretty much everybody in the same way. There's very little controversy about that. By gravity, we mean general relativity. That means space-time is described by a differentiable manifold with a Lorentzian metric satisfying the Einstein equations. People don't disagree with that. That's what we mean by gravity. That's our best theory of gravity. Quantum theory, well, here we really do face a choice about what approach to quantum theory we're going to take in trying to unify gravity with it. And the approach to quantum theory that we're going to take in taking this road, following this road, is the sum over histories. And I mean to say that we're going to consider the sum over histories, or the path integral, to be fundamental, the fundamental entity in a quantum theory. And that's in contrast to an approach in which you take the state vector of, say, a canonical quantization of some classical Hamiltonian theory as fundamental. So sum over histories rather than state vector and Hermitian operators. And so that's very vague. What does that mean? Well, it means that in searching for a quantum theory of gravity, we're led to consider this thing here. So it's a path integral, and it's a path integral for gravity, in other words, for space-times. So the histories that we're going to sum over will be whole space-times. So there should be a sum over manifolds here, and then an integral, path integral over metrics on those manifolds. Renata Lowell calls this a statement of intent, which I like a lot. So this doesn't exist even formally. And what Renata means when she calls this a statement of intent is that we want to do something like this. But this in itself, it doesn't exist. We have to give either a more fundamental meaning to it, a more fundamental definition of it, or some way of calculating this this thing as concretely as perhaps the limit of some sums that you can actually do. Okay, so we're aiming to define what this is in our quantum theory of gravity. That's a statement, the consequence of taking the sum over histories as fundamental. Now, the technical problems of defining this thing in the continuum are, I think, intractable. And I once asked Raphael about that, and he said he wasn't impressed. He wasn't impressed by the difficulty of defining this in the continuum. And that's not to, he didn't mean that it wasn't difficult. He meant that it was so difficult that it's not, you don't even need to try. So the response to that complete intractability of defining this this sum over histories in the continuum is to go discrete. Okay, that's discretize this, if you like, or postulate some more fundamental discrete structures that we will perform the sum over. Okay, so I think it's fair to say that discreteness is part of the zeitgeist. Maybe one reason for that is the rise of digital computing and the algorithms. But in physics, we have evidence for the discreteness of space-time which is strong, but certainly only circumstantial. We don't have physical evidence that space-time is discrete. That circumstantial evidence includes divergences that arise in continuum theories, quantum field theory, and general relativity. Probably the strongest evidence, physical evidence, for the discreteness of space-time is the value of the black hole entropy. And it both strongly suggests discreteness of space-time, and it tells us what the scale of that discreteness is, what scale we should expect the discreteness to pertain at. And that scale is the Planck scale. Okay, so let me draw a picture of a black hole. Black hole horizon. So if you haven't seen this picture, it's fun to see. So I learned this from Raphael, but I don't know whether it originates with him. So if you think about the horizon of a black hole as a two-sphere, and you divide up that horizon into plaquettes, little areas of length scale L. And then you just say, well, let's suppose that we paint a 0 or a 1 on every plaquette, and we can count the number of states, the number of ways in which we can do that. Okay. So how many plaquettes are there? Well, it's the area of the black hole divided by L squared. That's the number of plaquettes. So how many states are there? Well, there are therefore 2 to the n states. States of 0, 1 in each plaquette. And if the entropy is the log of the number of states, if S goes like the log of the number of states, and that goes like n, which goes like a over r squared. Okay. Now we know the answer to the question of what the black hole entropy is, and that's some kind of miracle because it's 2 pi times the area of L Planck squared, where L Planck is 8 pi g h bar square root. And it's a miracle because this is an answer to a quantum gravity question. It's quantum gravitational because it has g and h bar in. We don't have a theory of quantum gravity, but we already know the answer to one question, which is what is the entropy of the black hole. Oh, this is just a heuristic. It's nobody really believes that there really are zeros and ones painted on the horizon. So it's just, it makes this toy model discrete. So you want a discrete set of values. I mean, you could have some finite set of values, and that wouldn't change the value of the entropy. It would stay the same order of magnitude. So, yeah. Okay. So if you compare this with this, then it says that the fundamental scale of the discreteness should be the Planck scale. All right. All right, so what else is in the air? Well, there's holography. And going along with holography, there are often statements that there should be finite amounts of information in finite regions of space-time. People think about entropy bounds, entropy density associated with certain hypersurfaces, null hypersurfaces in space-time. And they all seem to point to some underlying discrete atomic structure to space-time. So I already said black hole entropy suggests that the discreteness is fundamental, that it's not merely a technical device to calculate Z. And another way to think about that is that if you were to calculate what's called the entanglement entropy of some quantum field in a black hole spacetime, then that entanglement entropy is indeed proportional to the area of the horizon, but it becomes infinite if you take the short distance or high energy cutoff away. So in the continuum, one would expect that the black hole entropy would diverge. So if the discrete, so the black hole entropy, the finiteness of the black hole entropy suggests that discreteness is fundamental. It's not something you're going to take away at the end. We're going to take this seriously. We're going to commit to discreteness as fundamental. So we're not going to take any continuum limit. And that's something which you can ask about any theory of quantum gravity which appears to have discrete elements. You can ask, are you going to take the continuum limit, or is your theory going to are you considering it to be fundamentally discrete? Okay, so we're not going to take continuum limit. One of the ideas behind causal sets is that the discreteness remains physically finite. It's Planckian in scale. So the question then becomes, what are the discrete manifolds? And this term is due to, Riemann uses this term. What are the discrete manifolds as opposed to continuum manifolds? What are the discrete manifolds that contribute to the sum over histories for quantum gravity? Okay, so before answering that question, let's have another look at the continuum. Let's look at continuum gravity. So general relativity, our best theory of gravity, tells us that space-time is a four-dimensional differentiable manifold, M, with a metric field G, with Lorentzian signature. So in four dimensions, it's minus, plus, plus, plus. And the metric gives us the causal structure of space-time. And the causal structure gives us 9/10 of the metric back. So causal structure is almost all of the metric. Okay. So what do I mean with that? What is causal structure? Okay. So I'm going to give some definitions. This is all in the continuum. So if there exists a future pointing time-like curve from x to y, x and y are points in M, then we say that x is in the causal path, x is in the causal past of y, is in the causal future of x, and I'm going to write that as x, time-like, chronological, past and future. I'm going to denote that by this double less than sign. Okay, so that means that x and y are time-like related, and x is to the past of y. And I'll define I plus of x to be all the points y in M such that x is to the chronological past of y. And if there exists a future pointing causal curve, non-space-like curve, y, we say that x is in the causal past of y, y is in the causal future of x, and we write, we use this less than or equal to sign, x is less than or equal to y, and we define j, the causal future of x, to be all the points y such that x is to the causal past of y. So this relation causal to the causal Pastov is the causal structure. It's what we mean by the causal structure of MG. And it's fixed by the metric because you know when curves are time-like or space-like because you just plug them into the metric and see whether you plug the tangent vectors into the metric and see whether they're time-like or space-like. So the metric tells you what time-like curves are and space-like curves are, so you can determine the causal structure. Okay. So this relation is mathematically, it's what's known in the known mathematically as a partial order. So long as the space-time has no closed causal loops, which I'm just assuming all the time now. It's a partial order. In other words, if x is to the causal past of y, and y is to the causal past of z, then x is to the causal past of z. That's called the transitivity relation. Transitivity condition. That's for all x, y, z, m. And x proceeds, x is to the causal past of x. And if x precedes y and y precedes x, then x is equal to y. So this condition is acyclic. Acyclicity. That means there are no loops, no causal loops. So that's the definition of partial order, these conditions. And there are a few other facts about the relationship between causal structure and chronological structure that I'm going to use. So they are that I plus is an open set. And in fact, it's the boundary, topological boundary, of J plus of X. So it's the interior. So if you take the causal future of a point and subtract the boundary, then you get, you're left with the chronological future. And if x is less than y, and y is time-like, in the time-like past, chronological past of z, then x is in the chronological past of z. These two things go together. Okay. All right. So the causal structure.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
What's the reason with the symbol x less than 1? Because before it was less or equal.
Right. So. Okay, good. Yeah. So x less than y. X less than or equal to y and x not equal to y. Yeah. Okay, thanks. Yeah. Are there other questions? It's 9/10 of the metric. 40. Okay, so let me quote the theorem. Which is due to, let me say, Hawking. So it's the final result of many steps proved by many different people. But the major results are due to Hawking, Malamut, and Levachev. Okay, so let MG and M primed, G primed, be distinguishing 4D Lorentzian manifolds. And D is, And let F from M to M primed be a causal isomorphism, causal bijection. I.e., F of X less than or equal to F of Y, if and only if X is less than or equal to Y. It's a bijection, so you can go the other way. I'm not sure if this condition is this independent? Minus one of P less than or equal to F minus one of Q, if and only if P is Q. Okay, so that this is, it's a bijection. It must be equivalent, right? Okay. So it's a bijection between the two manifolds, but all you know about it is that if two points are causally related in one, then their images are causally related in the other. That's all you know. You don't even know that it's continuous. Okay. And this, the theorem says then that F is, it's not just continuous, but it's smooth, and it's not just smooth, but it's what's known as a conformal isometry. Smooth conformal isometry. I.e., so it's a diffeomorphism, and the pullback of the metric G primed by F to M is G equals up to a conformal factor. So I'll just pull that omega. So the two metrics are almost the same metric. They are just related by an overall conformal factor. And if you then do the counting, the conformal factor is one space-time function. And a symmetric matrix field, symmetric 4x4 matrix field, has 10 free functions worth of information. So if the conformal factor is one free function, you don't know what that is, then the other nine, you know. So you know nine, and the other one is free. That's the conformal factor. Okay. Now, proving that theorem is hard, and it would take, I'm not sure I could even do it, actually. And it would certainly take a, you know, course of lectures to go through the proof. Okay. So I'm not going to even attempt to do that. But what I'm going to do is give you a couple of small things which hopefully give you a flavor of how the causal structure can give you geometrical information. So anyone have any questions about that?
What is a bijection?
It's a one-to-one correspondence, so it's injective and surjective. So yeah, they have.
And what does it mean, distinguishing it?
Oh, yeah. Good. Thank you. All right. Good point. Okay. So distinguishing spacetimes are ones which satisfy certain causality condition, which is stronger, strictly stronger, than there being no closed causal loops. So distinguishing spacetimes are ones which satisfy the condition that any two distinct points in the spacetime have distinct causal futures and distinct causal pasts. So if X is not equal to Y, then the causal, actually I think that's I said that wrong. They have distinct chronological futures and distinct chronological pasts. So the chronological future of X is not equal to the chronological future of Y if the space-time is distinguishing, and similarly for the past. You can have past distinguishing, but space-times which are past distinguishing but not future distinguishing, and vice versa as well. But these have to be they have to be both past and future distinguishing. Good. In fact, that reminded me, I should say something else, which is that these authors proved it for four dimensions, but it's actually true for any dimension d greater than or equal to 3. But the way that they proved it, you have to assume that the two spacetimes have the same dimension. It can be anything, but greater than or equal to 3, but they have to have the same dimension. However, if you strengthen this condition distinguishing to a condition called strongly causal, and I'm going to actually define what strongly causal is in a minute, then you can drop the condition that they have the same dimension. So in fact, if the spacetimes are strongly causal, then you don't even need to assume they have the same dimension. So long as there is a causal bijection between them, then they have the same dimension, and there's a smooth conformal isometry. Yes?
How can there be a one-to-one correspondence with space of two different dimensions?
Oh, well, I mean, that goes back to, you know, the beginnings of an algebra. I mean, there are these, for example, these space-filling curves. I mean, you can have... you can even have continuous maps between spacetimes of different. No, they're not bijective. Okay. So you can have these space-filling curves. That's an example of. You know those? You can't really draw them, but they're. They get more and more wiggly. I don't know how you construct those. You start with.
You can't find a discrete space or a continuum. You're saying you can take a continuum two-dimensional space with a continuum two-dimensional space.
Well, let's say so. Okay, so for example. The real line and the plane have the same cardinality, right? So there's a bijection. And I can construct explicitly. Yes, yeah, so I can explicitly construct a bijection between R and R cross R. So yeah. So in fact, Rn has the same cardinality as R. So for example. That's simpler than the space filling curve.
And you might have used the axiom of choice or something. I'm not sure. But, yeah, I suspect you do. I'm not sure maybe you can get away with that.
Shall I sketch? I mean, I could sketch a. Let me sketch a simple map between R and R. So a real number has a decimal expansion. So let's say, so we want to construct F between R cross R and R. All right, so let's take, we want to define F of R1, R2. All right, so R1 is N1, that's some integer, dot. Okay, and these are all this is its decimal expansion, let's call it A1, B1, C1, etc. I mean, I know there's only finitely many letters, but we just imagine you've got infinitely many symbols. R2 is N2, A2, B2, C2. Okay. Whoops. Okay. So there's there's a bijection between Z cross Z and Z. Oops. So Z cross Z. So there exists a bijection. Let me call it G from Z cross Z. to Z. Is that because they're countable? So right. So. So we'll define F as R1, R2 to be equal to G of N1, N2. That's the integer part. Dot A1A, A1A2, B1, B2, C1, C2. Okay. I claim that's a bijection. So it's a bijection because every number, every real number R comes from some pair of real numbers R1 and R2 by this map. And it's unique. So if you start here with two different pairs, then you'll get two different numbers. So it's onto and it's one to one, so it's a bijection. Are there other questions?
You didn't use the axiom of choice.
Oh, hooray.
Very subtle. I mean, what did you think that this was continuous in this way? So I'm not sure. Well, I certainly shouldn't think that it's smooth or anything like that.
I think the axiom of choice is an integer.
You think so?
Because you have to think for the set of A1 to A, A1 to A1, B1, C1, 2, infinity, you have to pick one from each.
No, I use them all.
Just people are back and forth between one and the other, and they go on.
Yeah, but isn't that an integer set? I mean, I think one infinite times you have to make one.
But you always know which one you print. So it's just bouncing back and forth. Right? From here to, you pick this one, and this one, and this one.
Yes,
That's not a much weaker thing than the axiom of choice. So the axiom of choice would be that at each stage you had an infinite number of possibilities and you had to pick from each one of those one of the possibilities. But here you have only one possibility at each stage. So there really was no choice. It was a deterministic process.
Okay, so F is a bijection.
I think there was a lot of confusion with this in the history of statistical mechanics. Probably not worth going, especially since I wouldn't guarantee I know the history that well. There's something called the ergodic hypothesis, which is the idea that if you try to do average over time, it's a statistical thing. It's the same as taking an ensemble average. And the intuitive idea was, well, the path of the system point, you know, all these molecules moving around represented as one point in configuration space, but that path is so complicated that if you wait long enough, it visits every point in the configuration space, or in the phase space, I should say. And therefore, if you wait long enough, you end up averaging over the whole phase space. That's justified, it turns out, replacing time averages by ensemble averages. But only later people came to realize that that's impossible, because even though phases showed that it was possible, that a one-dimensional thing, which is a curve, could be put in one-to-one correspondence with a two-dimension or obviously any finite dimension. Her map is not smooth, which the trajectory in phase space is always a differentiable function. And then it's not possible to do something like this. But if you relax smoothness and you even relax continuity, then you can do this.
I think there is a stronger version of this theorem saying that you can have a measure preserved in bijection. And this probably requires the absence of choice.
So
if you have a measure on the line, then you can turn it into a measure on the plane.
And in fact, even those ergodic maps can go one way. So the things that people were, like Boltzmann and Hoare were imagining don't exist because the map, because the trajectory is smooth. But if you said it was only continuous and not smooth, so that small changes went to small changes, but not necessarily differentially, then you could have the onset. So then the curve could actually cover up the whole phase space, even though it's only one dimensional. Those are those space curves. But it would cover for some points more than one. So it wouldn't be a bijection.
Okay, so yeah, so bijection is a very weak condition. But causal structure preserving is incredibly strong. It forces this bijection to be not just continuous, but smooth, not just smooth, but almost an isometry. Okay.
Yeah? Does this theorem work the other way around?
Yes. It's the metrics that conform more than the causal structures are the same. Yeah. Because a curve which is time-like or causal in one metric will be time-like or causal in the other. Because if you just multiply, so this is some positive number. If you just multiply the norm of a vector in one metric by a positive number, then if it's negative, it remains negative. If it's positive, it remains positive. If it's null, it remains null. So the causal structure is, yeah.
I mean, when we write down a Penrose diagram, what you do is you try to make the metric conformal to the Einstein static universe. And then what you do is you look at the coordinate ranges on the conformal factor, and you'll find that globally they don't actually have the same ranges, so you have a different causal structure. And then you can, causal structure of Minkowski space is not the same as its static universe, even though they're conformal contours. I can see it locally, but you see what I mean?
No.
The idea is you make a conformal transformation that makes the metric conformal.
Okay, hold on. Let me write this down.
Something sort of static.
Right, let me write
it down. And then that embeds the space-time in the static universe, but it might not affect the whole.
So maybe it just doesn't fit into this, what you're thinking about doesn't fit into that. So you've got two.
It's not in my direction. It doesn't come out of the
moment. Oh, that's a problem.
All right.
I didn't know this, but they assume that in that theorem you assume that M and M prime are both manifolds of the same dimension?
Yes. Yeah. So Sumati Surya has told me that she thinks that even for distinguishing space times, you can drop that condition that they have the same dimension. So I haven't yet. So that's all I know. She's told me that she has extended the result to drop the condition that they have the same, this result to drop the condition that they have the same space. But I know for sure that if you strengthen the condition from distinguishing to strongly causal, then you can drop the condition that they have the same dimension. So Sumati thinks that it works.
I was going to ask if there are any known counterexamples. There must not be a Sumati thing.
Yes, I'll have to check with her what her current thing is. Which makes it, there's some mystery there, which I can tell you about later.
What is the definition of strongly?
Good. Haha. Thank you. Definition. Okay. So a space-time, in other words, a Lorentzian manifold, is strongly causal. Excellent. If for any point in M and any neighborhood U of P, there exists a sub-neighborhood V in some subset of U, such that any causal curve that passes through V intersects it only once, exactly once, such that any causal curve through V intersects it exactly once. Okay, so what does that mean? So it means here's the point P, and here's your neighborhood U. The condition of strong causality says that you can find a subneighborhood V such that if gamma is some causal curve which passes through V, it never comes back. So once it's gone, once it's left the region, it's gone forever. It never comes back. And that condition means that the local causal structure is the global causal structure restricted to the neighborhood, because so this means that the causal structure in V, in other words, the question of whether there are time-like curves, whether there are causal curves between points in V, causal curves that remain in V for the whole time, this is the global causal structure, so the causal structure in M, restricted to V. Okay, because since if X, okay, I'm going to use this it's Raphael's terminology for space-like. That means X, if space-like to Y, means that X is not to the causal past of Y and Y is to the not to the causal past of X. They're not causally related in either direction. In V, then X in M. Because if two points causally not related, X and Y, in V, that means there's no causal curve that remains in V that connects them. But any causal, so there might be, so could there be a causal curve that comes out of V and comes back? Well, there can't be by strong causality. So X is not, that X is therefore also space-like to Y in M. Okay, are there questions about that strong causality? Yes?
I'm not sure if I understand this very well. I can imagine a very complicated geometry for V where you cannot, maybe I cannot, but I imagine it could be a complicated geometry in V where you cannot connect from X to Y in a causal way, but in the bigger thing in U, you can. And you, is that?
Yes, that's possible. But the condition of strong causality is that if that happens, you can always find there is some neighborhood which is small enough, tight enough around P, such that can no longer happen. That any causal curve that leaves the neighborhood can then never come back again. So it may be true that there's some. I mean, trivially you can do this. Right? I mean, trivially you could have some. What could you do? Oh, okay. So you can have, in Minkowski space-time, you could have some neighborhood like that, right? So that causal curve intersects it twice. But that's not, you don't worry about, that's not some kind of causality violation, right? So you say, well, that's a bad neighborhood, but I can always find a neighborhood where that doesn't happen. So that the curve, that once they leave, they can't come back. Okay, are there other questions?
That the original theorem applies to dimension 4 higher than?
Higher than 3, I think. 3 and higher. It just doesn't hold in 2. I think that's.
My question is, assuming that both space times are strongly causal, is there a minimum dimension for either of them?
Right. I'm not exactly sure, but good question. the result that I know, I can't say for sure with my hand on my heart that I know that it holds for all dimensions. Okay, but the theorem is that if a space-time is strongly causal, then the what's known as the Alexandrov topology, and I'll say that what that is in a minute, is the manifold topology. Okay. So if the causal structure can determine the Alexandrov topology, then it determines the manifold topology and tells you, in particular, it tells you the dimension. Okay. So what's the Alexandrov topology? The Alexandrov topology is the topology which is generated by the chronological intervals. Right, so if I define A x y to be equal to the set of points z in M such that y is to the chronological past of z, which is to the chronological past of x, and of course you require that y is past of x. So if you take all such, so these are open sets in the manifold topology. If you take all such and you define, and you take them as a base of a new topology, that's called the Alexandrov topology. And that is the manifold topology when it's strong, when spacetimes are strongly causal. Okay, so can you determine this from the causal structure? Okay, that's the question. If you just know the causal structure, can you determine the chronological structure? And the answer is yes, in strongly causal spacetimes. So in strongly causal spacetime, the causal structure determines the chronological structure, which gives you the manifold topology, which gives you the dimension. But I would say I can't, with my hand on my heart, say what dimension that holds in.
That's probably in any dimension.
Is that in any dimension?
In two? I'm not sure, but I think that in two dimensions, thing which fails is the smoothness, the differentiable structure, which is probably the most subtle thing to explain the distinction between the differentiable structure and the topology. So the difference between continuous and differentiable in the function. So the fact that you can do differential geometry means you have a differential structure that you know which functions on the manifold have gradients and which ones don't. And, you know, when a curve is a smooth curve and when it's just continuous without being smooth, it will zigzag you like the Brownian motion curves. So that's the differentiable structure. I mean, it could be defined, but probably it's not worth taking time out to define it. But you could find it in any textbook, definition of even atlases of differentiable charge, blah, 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 blah. But that, you know, until you have that differentiable structure, you can't really do calculus, or you can't do differential geometry, which relatively means, of course. So that's the one thing that I believe you don't get back in two dimensions, just from the causal structure.
Just one more question.
Yep.
Say, sort of
open? Yes. Those sets are
I plus is an interior of your plus.
Yeah.
So that your plus could be called.
Ah, but this is chronological. So it's the intersection of the chronological future of X of Y with the chronological past of X. Yeah. Okay, so let me a couple more definitions. So a subset A of, let me call it something else, S of M, is totally ordered if you take two elements of A, then either X is to the causal past of Y, or Y is to the causal past of X. So they're ordered in some way, causally. So all elements of the, any pair of elements of your set, do that. Are ordered, then the set is called totally ordered. Another name for this, a set like this, is a chain, also called a chain. All right. And definition. Now I'm going to define, this was, if you like, the chronological interval between x and y, and I'll define the causal interval I of x and y. To be z in M, such that y is less than or equal to z, is less than or equal to x. This is the intersection of the causal future of y and the causal past of x. And as you said, this is, it's certainly not open, but it doesn't have to be closed. So sometimes it's missing bits of its boundary, if you like. So for example, if you take Minkowski space with this point missing, so just excise that point, then take a point here, y, then the causal future of y is missing those points there on the boundary. So it's not necessarily a closed set. All right, that's the causal interval between x and y. Okay. All right. Now, let's consider. So this is all a bit of a. This is all background for giving you a little flavor for how causal structure can give you geometry. So let's do a simple example. So let's consider just Minkowski spacetime of d dimensions. And I'm going to define, so another definition, a partial null line, or PNL, is a totally, PNL is a totally ordered subset. Call it L, such that
did you use the one in
between? Okay.
Did I use that? There's another blackboard.
Such that. If you take two elements of L and Y is to the causal past of X, then the causal interval between Y and X is also in L. Then the causal interval XY is a subset of L. Okay, So why is that a good definition? Well, let's think about a set in Minkowski spacetime. Here's our set. Now, to be a partial null line, it's got to have the property that it's a total order. Okay, well, that's not a total order because this point and that point are space-like to each other. They're not ordered. They're not in the causal past or future of each other. So anything that contains an open set will not do. Can't be a partial null line. So it's got to be a line, if you like. Right? So here's a nice totally ordered set in Minkowski spacetime. Every element is causally related to every other element. However, it's not true if this, so this is a timeline line. This doesn't have the property that the interval between any pair of its points is also contained in the set, because here's one point, here's another point. What's the interval between them? The interval between them looks like this. And that's not contained in the set. So any kind of line is a total order, totally ordered set. But it doesn't have the property that the interval between any two of its points is in the set. And the only way you can satisfy that condition is for the subset to be a null line or partial null line. So any segment like that of a null line will do. So that's why partial null line is a good definition. It is a partial null line. Are there questions about that? And if you notice that definition, it uses only the causal information. That's all you need to know. So if you know the causal structure, then you know which subsets of Minkowski spacetime are partial null line. And then a null line, in other words, an infinite one, is a maximal partial null line. So it's a partial null line such that you can't add any other points to it, and it remain a partial null line. That means it will have to, it has to extend off to infinity to be a null line. All right. So you can see that the causal information allows you to construct these geometrical objects, these null lines. Now, it turns out that if your space-time is strongly causal, then you just maintain this definition of partial null line. Again, you define partial null lines to be a totally ordered subset of the space-time such that this condition holds. Those partial null lines include all the null, locally at least, all the null geodesics. Okay. So if MG is strongly causal, then the collection of partial null lines, as defined here, contain all local null geodesics. Okay, what do I mean by that? All right, so more accurately, consider point P in M and a convex normal neighborhood of P. Convex normal neighborhood V of P. It's strongly causal, so the causal structure in the neighborhood V is determined by the global causal structure. So if we know the global causal structure, then we know the causal structure in this convex normal neighborhood. And the null geodesics from P, okay, then the null geodesics from P in V are partial null lines. Okay, so I'm going to prove that now. So here's P, and here's a convex normal neighborhood, V, in which we have Riemann normal coordinates. And the thing about Riemann normal coordinates is that in those coordinates, the light cone from P, the light cones, past and future, are the Minkowski ones. So in Riemann normal coordinates, the light cones from P are defined in exactly the way that they're defined in Minkowski spacetime. They're defined by this. Okay. So they look like this. And the causal structure here at P is just like in a piece of Minkowski spacetime. The causal future of P is the light cone and everything inside it. The causal past of P is the light cone and everything inside that. And everything outside here is space-like to P. Okay, that's so that's true in any manifold. It doesn't have to be strongly causal. There, you can find convex normal neighborhoods such that the local causal structure looks just like in Minkowski spacetime. Yes. Yes, a convex normal neighborhood is one in which any two points have a unique geodesic between them. That's the definition of, yeah, which is in the neighborhood. So it contains, the neighborhood contains that there's a unique geodesic in that neighborhood between any two of its points. That condition might be too strong, but we can always find one, so let's take it to be convex normal. So this is always true. The condition of strong causality says that that local causal structure is the global causal structure. So this point here, Q, which is space-like to P in V, is space-like to P in M. Right, that's the... Right, so what was the claim? The claim was that the null geodesics from P and V are partial null lines. So if that's true, if every null geodesic from P in V is a partial null line, then when you take the collection of all partial null lines through P, then you know you've got the you've included all the null geodesics. Okay. So let's consider a point Q here on the light cone from P. So consider Q on the light cone. So that's the boundary of the causal future of P. Now, there exists a unique null geodesic, gamma, from P to Q. You know that because the null geodesics are the straight lines in these Riemann normal coordinates. They're just the usual things, okay, in Riemann normal coordinates. So this gamma is just this straight line here in these coordinates from P to Q. And this gamma, by definition, is a subset of the interval from between P and Q. And the claim is that gamma is a partial null line. That's the claim. All right. So what condition does a partial null line have to satisfy? It has to be totally ordered, and it has to contain every interval between them, between any two of its points. Okay. If we can show that gamma actually is this interval, then we'll have shown that gamma is a partial null line. Okay. So now I'm going to show that gamma is not just contained in this interval, but is actually equal to the interval. So let's consider... So let X be in the interval Q and P. Now, because X is in the interval between P and Q, there's a causal curve from P to X and then to Q. Do I want to say that? Okay, yeah. First of all, X is in this interval, but it cannot be in the interior of the causal future of P. Okay. Why is that? Because if it's in the interior, that means it's chronologically related to P. It's time-like to P. And then X is causally related to Q. And if something in that situation, that means that P is then chronologically related to Q. So let me say that. So X is in the boundary of P, because otherwise, if it's inside, if it's in the interior, X, then P would be chronologically related to X. If it's in the interior, then it's time-like related. And X is causally related to Q, which would imply that P is chronologically related to Q, which is a contradiction. They're not chronologically related. There's no time-like curve from P to Q. You know what the time-like... the causal structure is exactly as in Minkowski spacetime. The points which are time-like related to P are the interior of the light cone only. Okay. So does this... Are you happy with this deduction? Let me just... Alright, so X is on the boundary, X is on the light cone somewhere. It's on this light cone. So there exists, and there exists a causal curve from P to X to Q. That causal curve can't be time-like anywhere, because if it was time-like anywhere, then P and Q would be time-like related. We know they're not time-like related. And therefore, this curve must be null everywhere. Let's call it causal curve gamma prime. So gamma prime must be null. So we've got the situation where here is P, here is Q, and gamma is the geodesic. And we've got some other null curve, gamma, which must remain everywhere on the boundary, must remain everywhere on the light cone. And gamma primed must not go into the interior. Because again, if gamma prime is a causal curve from P to Q. If it goes into the interior, that means that P and Q are time-like related, but they're not. Contradiction. So it's a null curve on the light cone on the boundary. But that can't happen unless it's the geodesic. Okay, it can't happen unless it actually is the geodesic, and therefore it must be equal to gamma itself. So any null curve from P must be the geodesic. Must be a geodesic, because otherwise... Sorry, any null curve from P on the boundary must be a geodesic, because otherwise it will enter the interior. Okay, and it enters the interior because consider a null curve from P. It starts out... It has null tangent, so it starts out tangent to the light cone. At every point on the light cone, there's one null direction tangent to the null to the light cone, and that's along the null geodesic generators, which in this case are just the straight lines. Okay? All other tangents are space-like. All other tangent vectors are space-like. So you start off tangent to the null geodesic. You have to stay null and stay tangent. And the only way that you can do that is to carry on along the geodesic. If you deviate off the geodesic, then the null, then the tangent vector will then go space-like. So this uses this fact that at any point on the cone, there's one null direction tangent to the cone, that's along the geodesic generator, and all the other directions are space-like. What did I do with it? Interior, since at any point on D plus, on D of J plus of P, there is exactly one null tangent direction. That's along the null geodesic generator. And all other tangents are space-like. So it can't go space-like, so it has to remain null, so it has to keep pointing along the geodesic. Okay. So therefore, this gamma primed, which is a null curve which stays on the boundary from P, must be equal to gamma. So that means that this point X that we were considering, the one that was in the interval, that point X is in the interval, it's on this curve, gamma prime is equal to gamma, and therefore X is in gamma. So that implies that gamma is equal to the interval QP. And gamma is a partial null line. Okay. So that means if you have the causal structure of a strongly causal spacetime, then you also have in your hand a collection of subsets which includes all the local null geodesics at all the points of spacetime. Are there questions about that? You can also show the converse, that the partial null lines are null geodesics. So we showed that null geodesics are partial null lines. You can show that partial null lines are null geodesics, but I won't go through that. It's a very similar proof. All right. So now suppose we have the topology and the differentiable structure. And as Raphael said, this is the subtle thing. It's hard to prove that you have different. You can construct the differentiable structure from the causal structure. That's the contribution that Stephen Hawking made. So in the Hawking-Malamud-Levachev theorem, the Hawking part is showing that the causal structure gives you the differentiable structure. Okay, so you do have them. That's hard, so we're not going to do that. See that. Then, and we have the collect. We know what the local null geodesics are. Then we can identify. So if we have the differentiable structure, we have the tangent space. We can identify in the tangent space which vectors are null, because we look to see the null vectors are tangent to curves which are tangent to null geodesics. So we just check through to see whether the each vector is tangent to one of the partial null lines. And the ones that are, we say those are null. And we're guaranteed to get them all because our set of partial null lines includes all these local null geodesics. Then we know what I'll call N, a subset of the tangent space of P, the null cone. And that's the set of null vectors in TP. And if you know those, then you can get the metric up to a conformal factor. And that is half a page of proof in Hawking and Ellis. Since I have 5 minutes, I'm going to do that. And get across the set. Right. So, okay. So, claim. This gives the metric up to conformal factor. And that's in Hawking and Ellis. Okay. Actually, I'm not going to do it because I've got 5 minutes and I haven't even said what a causal set is, which is kind of ridiculous. So if you'll forgive me, you can look it up. It's literally, as I say, it's half a page. So it's very easy. Okay. Good. Right. So let's return to the question of what the discrete manifolds in the sum over histories are. And if we're serious about this continuum expression, Z is equal to the path integral over metrics, path integral over continuum geometries, if we're serious about that being a statement of intent, then some of our discrete manifolds that go in the sum over histories must be approximated by Lorentzian manifolds. And if we want them to be fundamental, we want to really build a fundamental theory on them, they must be in some sense non-ad hoc. There must be some kind of rigidity in their definition that means that you can't fiddle with the definition too much, okay, or at all. Okay. So what could they be? And let's get a handle on this by going the other way around. Let's start with continuum manifolds and discretize them. Okay. So here's a simple example to start with. So suppose we have matter in a box in ordinary 3D space, and suppose it's described by some continuum mass density rho. And we have some reason to suspect that actually it's made of atoms. It's not really continuous, but is fundamentally granular. How would we guess, how would we find an atomic distribution, an atomic state, to which this could be a good approximation? Well, one way to do that is simply discretize this. So go from this to this, and then see whether this atomic state makes sense by itself. Okay. So what you do is you distribute the atoms in the box roughly so that the number of atoms that you have in a region is given by the mass in the region. And what's the mass? The mass is just the density integrated over that region. So where the density is low, and the mass is therefore low, you put fewer elements, and where it's high, you put more. Okay. Then you throw away rho. So then you forget the continuum distribution and see if it makes sense to propose this atomic state as the fundamental thing and this as an approximation. So you have to see, can you recover rho from this? And you'll find that you can't recover exactly the rho you started with, but the one you do recover, which you get by just sort of smearing this out, the one you do recover should be approximately equal to the one you started with. That's a requisite for this to be a sensible fundamental theory. And then you have to see whether you can give it dynamics of its own. You have to be able to breathe life into this atomic distribution, give it its own dynamics, and see if you can build your fundamental theory on that. Okay, so that seems relatively straightforward, although perhaps if you think about it a little, it's rather subtle. Let's do the same thing with space-time. So we have reason to suspect that space-time is fundamentally discrete. So let's do what we did for the matter in a box. Let's distribute discrete identical atoms of space-time throughout space-time in such a way as respect the amount of space-time in any region. In other words, the space-time volume. So what plays the role of the mass density for our matter example is the volume density. The space-time volume element, we integrate that over any region, then that gives us the space-time volume of that region. So we just place the atoms into our space-time, and I'll henceforth call these atoms elements, so that roughly the number of elements that you put in each region is given by the volume, where we're measuring the volume in fundamental near Planck units. And we can satisfy this requirement by distributing the elements randomly by a Poisson process we've referred to as sprinkling. You can think of the Poisson process as take space-time, divide it up into little volumes of volume, each one epsilon, and you put a point, put an element in that region with probability epsilon, and you leave it empty with probability 1 minus epsilon, and then you take the limit as epsilon goes to 0. That's the Poisson process. And what it gives you is something like this. So this is a picture that David Rideout produced. It's got about...
Yes. How much should we continue your lecture tomorrow, or what do you think? I'm not sure how much more is to come.
Probably about half.
about half is to come, then, which is certainly continuing tomorrow.
Okay. That's fine with me.
Yeah, so why don't you go to what you think is a reasonable stopping point? Because obviously you won't finish today.
Okay. This is a reasonable stopping point, I guess. Well, let me just say a little bit more about it. So as I said, this is a picture that David produced. It's got about 16,000 elements in, I think. And it has this characteristic feature that any random distribution has, which is that it's not what you would do yourself if you were asked to put a whole bunch of points down uniformly in some region. In the sense that there are these little holes here, and overdensities here. So if you had a bunch of beans and you were asked to spread them out uniformly on the table, you wouldn't do that. You'd fill in these holes, right, and make it look ostensibly more uniform. However, that's in doing that, what you're actually doing is if there's an element somewhere, then you're making it less likely that you put another element close to it. A truly random distribution, one in which you place the points down independently of each other, in a way, so it doesn't, the fact that you've already, that you sprinkle a point here doesn't mean, it doesn't have any effect whatsoever on the probability that other points are sprinkled near it, that you place the other points down completely independently of what's already been placed down. That produces a picture like this, right, where there are these little voids and overdensities. So it's a sort of characteristic of the Poisson process that you get something that looks like this. However, this has the very special property that it's Lorentz invariant and doesn't pick out any frame. And what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is that if you take a piece of this distribution and you do a Lorentz boost on it, well, take the whole thing and boost it. What will happen is that it will spread out in one null direction, say this direction, and it will squash up in another in the other null direction, that direction. So you get a parallelogram shape. But then if you look at a piece, a square, so you get this parallelogram, then take a square piece of it, that piece in that piece, the distribution will look exactly like that. It won't be exactly this because the points will have moved about. But the distribution itself will be nice and uniform. They'll be nicely spread over the region. And you won't be able to tell. There's nothing about the distribution that tells you that you're in a boosted, that you're in boosted coordinates. You're in a frame that's been boosted with respect to this one. So the distribution has no frame information in it. It's a Lorentzian variant. It's a Lorentzian variant distribution of points. Okay. So I'll. Oh, so let me say. Maybe I can leave you on a cliffhanger. That would be good. So, in the matter in a box example, what we did then was we took the continuum rho, the mass density, and we just took it away, and you were just left with the atoms, and then the job was to make that into a build a theory on that. Okay. Now here, the continuum is the background space-time. It's Minkowski space-time. Okay. If we whisk that away, then these elements, you know, they just collapse in a heap, because if you take the if you take space-time away, they're in space. I mean, in the matter in a box, the atom. I mean, you're not taking space-time away. You're just taking the density away. There's still the background Euclidean metric of three-dimensional space for the atoms to sit in. So when you take away the continuum mass distribution rho, the atoms still stay there. They're just hanging there in the box. But in this, if you take away the space-time, there's nothing for these elements to. There's no information in just this for them to hold any kind of geometrical form. They just collapse into a heap of dust. So we can't, at this stage, remove the continuum. This isn't enough. So we have to add something else to this structure. And I'll continue next time, I guess, tomorrow. So are there any further questions? If you like, over lunch I can do this Hawking analysis calculation, but it's just as easy to look it up in the
proof that if you know the light cone,
the proof that if you know the null cone in the tangent space, then
scale.
Right, yeah. Are there other questions about? This theorem is not as well known as it should be. It's one of the major theorems of the golden age of global causal analysis. But yeah, not many people. It's kind of, maybe it's because it's a series of different theorems, and to put it into this form, you have to do a little bit of work. But it's.
Maybe for those who don't know, I should know all this. Formalism and technology that Faye was talking about—that was all developed for, and it's so far one of its main applications. Probably its biggest application has been to prove the singularity theorem. So the theorems that tell you, for example, that matter starts collapsing to form a black hole, and if it gets far enough, then the process must continue to form a singularity. So inside a black hole horizon, you know that you'll find a singularity within the confines of classical general relativity, of course. So I'm trying to think if there are other. I mean, that was the initial impetus for developing these ideas the way they have. So that although they look very abstract, they have a very practical implication. And historically, it was those theorems that first convinced people that there really were singularities in general. Then other developments came later which corroborated that. There was a time, for example, if you looked in some early edition of Landau's book, you'll find they said there are really no singularities in general relativity. Singularity in the Schwarzschild solution is just an artifact of the spherical symmetry, but as soon as you put in a little perturbation, you'll get a non-singular space-time. So there was a lot of confusion in it. It was these things that really clarified that and showed that singularities were inevitable. So that's the sort of the practical fruits of this. But if you go back a little further, there was a, since the very beginning of relativity, there was also this tradition that maybe what's really fundamental about space-time is not the distances, not the metric relationships, but really the causal structure. So very early on, people noticed, they didn't have this theorem, but they noticed that the causal structure contains a lot of information. There's a whole book by someone called Rob, A.A. Rob, who does, Euclidean geometry with axioms and triangles. He does the same thing for Lorentzian geometry. He writes down a bunch of axioms analogous to Euclid's axioms that show you how you can reproduce the structure of Minkowski spacetime just from a few simple notions, all of which ultimately are just based on the causal structure. So there's this tradition that the causal structure might be the most important structure that spacetime has. Philosophically, that resonates with some people have thought that causality is one of the most basic structures of our understanding. But in any case, in relativity, it's very concrete, the role that causality plays. And so this tradition, one of its first fruits was all these singularity theorems. But what causal sets is doing is essentially continuing that tradition and saying, maybe it's really true. Not only that you can derive certain interesting results by focusing on the causal structure, but maybe it's really true that that is the basic structure. But when it's combined with discreteness, it gives you the right framework for doing quantum gravity.
It certainly seems more physical than to say that space-time is a Lorentzian manifold. It's a curved manifold. It's just very hard to feel that. I mean, I'm not saying that we should be governed by, our feelings about what's real, but certainly we experience causal structure much more directly than, you spill your coffee on your lap and it's it has an effect, causal effect.
You're going to claim, I guess, tomorrow. So I guess you'll finish your talk tomorrow, and then I'll continue on and talk something about more precise mathematical definitions of post sets in discrete setting, which is what we've not come to yet, and then go on to describe these particular dynamical models for causal set dynamics called classical sequential growth models. But I think Fayla, in her talk tomorrow, you hinted that you were going to say that even if all you want is to understand the continuum, that somehow the meaning of Lorentzian vector in the continuum, Lorentzian signature in the continuum, that this discretization does it for you in a way. Is that correct?
Well, you'll see that it's hard to see Lorentz. It's hard to get an intuitive feeling for Lorentzian structure. It's because when you draw a space-time, you put on it, on the board or in your mind, you put Euclidean's metric on it. You can't help it. I mean, in a Lorentzian geometry, P and Q are null related, right? So if you the distance between them is, let's not talk about that one, but talk about a point here, just inside the light cone. That's R, say. That's very close to P in the true Lorentzian geometry. But any way you draw it, or put it on, or think about it in your mind, or draw it on the board or on a piece of paper, it looks far, right? Because you just can't help but put the Euclidean, use Euclidean geometry. It's there's nothing you can do in pictures to reveal the fact that these things are close. That's my claim. But if the Lorentzian structure is discrete, if the causal structure is discrete, you can see it directly. So I'll show you a picture tomorrow of that. So I'm not saying that means that that Lorentzian structure just doesn't is has to be discrete, but it certainly its essential nature is revealed by discreteness in a way that's not true of you, of Riemannian geometry. When you draw, you know, Riemannian geometry, you draw, you know, you draw some curved surface, and that's you. Your picture is intuitively true. I mean, you know, the picture is exactly what you think.
Tomorrow, 11:30. I don't know, I guess the room is in use at 11.